Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I'm Ben Bolin.
Ben, before we get into today's exciting, exciting topic, Chevy Corvair, we've got a major correction.
We have a huge correction and a bit of an apology.
Yeah, I'm red-faced reading this one because, I'll tell you the quick and simple way this came together was, we did a listener suggestion a few episodes ago.
We did two.
That's right, two. I still am smiling about this. We did two listener suggestions from a single reader or listener. Fast Sandy from the UK, right?
Uh-huh.
And Ben, you're laughing at me. I know that's...
I'm laughing at both of us,
I know
buddy.
Exactly why. So we did... First, we did the Donald Campbell at Constant Water.
Uh-huh.
Then we did the Isle of Man TT.
Correct.
Right? And I was thinking everything's going along great, and we were thanking Sandy the whole time for the suggestions, and... I get an email from Fast Sandy again, saying, "Oh, thanks for doing these. We appreciate it." Uh-huh. And by the way, I raced in the Isle of Man TT, and you guys asked about this. You know, did anybody race? And I didn't want to mention it, but I did race in that race. And
so we were floored.
I was like, "Oh my gosh, she races in the Isle of Man TT. This is awesome. How cool is this?" So we find out that Sandy raced in the Manx series, which is the amateur series.
Mm-hmm.
Also, sends along a couple of photos and says, "Hey, take a look at these." So I open the photos, and there's two photos of a motorcycle rider. Beautiful shots, by the way. The next one, the third shot, is of Sandy in the pit standing next to his bike.
Yes, and Sandy told us very politely in his email that his girlfriend, I believe, cracked up multiple times that we referred to Sandy as female.
And I listened to the Coniston Water episode, and I couldn't have said the word she anymore in the first few sentences. So I apologize, Sandy. Sandy is a male. In fact, the Isle of Man TT stuff is really, really cool. And we got into kind of a back and forth conversation that went on for a while. Found out that, not only did he race in the Manx series, but also... also was a monkey on a sidecar in another race, in another professional race, or amateur race, I guess, at a place called Oliver's Mount in the UK, but raced in the monkey position, Ben, as kind of a last-minute stand-in, is what he said.
Yeah, and this was really interesting to us because, Scott, you and I have talked about sidecar racing, and although I believe our podcast with it was filled with jokes about sidecar monkeys, one thing that we did hit on and that still really interests both of us is the fine art of sidecar racing, especially as the monkey. There's so much science behind your weight distribution and stuff. You're not just sitting in the sidecar, I think.
And
the point.
I swear to you with my hand up here that Ben and I have both talked about the monkey position on a sidecar so many times in this podcast studio that, if we had a nickel for every time, we'd have at least 50 cents.
We would at least be buying our own sodas.
Yeah. That's So anyway, Sandy, I truly, truly apologize. I know everybody got a good laugh out of it, on your end and maybe, on our end as well. We're kind of chuckling about it right now, but Sandy, I apologize. Mm-hmm. And, let's move on.
Yeah, and just thank you again for being such a good sport.
Very good sport.
Really appreciate it. And moving on, let's talk about a different listener, our buddy Joel. I guess I can say his full name because it's on Twitter.
Yeah, why not?
Our buddy Joel Rushworth, who sent us a wonderful suggestion. Joel, we hope you're listening because we're taking you up on the story of the Chevy Corvair. Joel sent us a really cool link, and then he wanted us to talk a little bit about the Chevy Corvair, about what happened to this, let's be honest, fairly revolutionary vehicle.
Yeah, it was revolutionary, but when I first heard this,
mm-hmm.
and I've had this impression in my mind ever since from the very beginning when I heard about the Corvair. Now, I've seen them for sale my whole life, really, on used car lists and things like that.
Because right.
Back when I was buying my first car in the late 1980s, mm-hmm. At that time, really, you could get one that wasn't that old. I mean, it would be akin to buying a car from the 90s right now.
Exactly.
Right? So it's not that old. It wasn't that old at that time, maybe 20 years old. But I'd always heard there was this really, really negative connotation along with the Corvair name.
Mm-hmm.
And I never got, you know, why that was. And I knew that there was a book written about it that, you know, was unsafe at any speed. And
that's,
you know,
by Ralph Nader.
Yeah, we'll get to all this. But I had this really, really negative connotation about the Corvair in general. And thought I would never get one because why would I do that to myself?
Mm-hmm.
Why would I put myself in danger? As it turns out, maybe I should have been looking at them a little more carefully as a, you know, even a potential first car.
Yeah, maybe bad press isn't always completely accurate. You know what I mean? There's a lot of I think there's a point we need to make. Now we're going to talk about a little bit about the origin of Corvair. Then we're going to talk about, I don't know, Scott, some of the differences maybe with the models.
Sure.
And how, the difference between when it first came out in 59 and later when the S hit the F. Fill in your own favorite words there, folks. And then we're going to explore some of the controversy here to go into this excellent suggestion by Joel. So just from the beginning, what we do want to put out there is that marketing and press can have such a tremendous impact on a car's success. And sometimes it can even make a car unsuccessful if there's not really that many problems.
Yeah, you want to hear something kind of unusual here? I found a quote from the guy who's General Motors, well, Chevrolet Division's general manager at the time. And I guess it was like 1959 we have to start at, really.
Okay.
Now, the Corvair, the first model year of the Corvair was 1960. Now,
yes.
In 1959, of course, they're doing their press thing and getting the vehicle out there and, you know, showing it to the public and letting people drive it.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I said 59. But
well, that's all right. No, yeah. 59 is good because that's the year that they were getting it out there and really showing it around. So the guy who was the Chevy general manager, his name was Edward N. Cole.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Cole, as was quoted in this book that I've got, it says, no one will know what the full effects of a car like the Corvair will have on the market. It all depends on the economy and how good a sales job our dealers do.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, right then he's very optimistic about this whole thing. You know, everything's going along really well. In fact, Time Magazine, they drove it in 1959. They really, really liked it
a
lot. And remember, 1959, Time Magazine says they love it. That'll be important later.
Yeah, remember that part. Oh, I've got something cool
sure.
here, too. This is even a little bit further back, a little bit earlier.
Oh, sure.
So, as we know, Ed Cole became the chief engineer of Chevy in 1952, right? And he asked Maurice Ollie, who at that time was head of R&D, to come up with something new. And so, as Ollie and Don McDonald, the subsequent head of R&D, recall, they went into Cole's office with all kinds of charts and programs covering every kind of car you can think of. Ed refused to look at them. "I don't want anything conventional," he said. "Get going on that rear engine."
Okay, get it. No, rear engine.
There we go.
That's the key, right? Because,
uh-huh.
Because this was a, in fact, this is the first time that, well, actually, even till today, I think, this is the, as I'll quote here, "This is the only American-designed, mass-produced passenger car with a rear-mounted air-cooled engine." Now, that's all very important that all those qualifiers are in there, air-cooled and rear-mounted, you know, all that. But very important car in General Motors history, very important car in American automotive history. And, Ben, I think this is one of the – boy, I can't be sure about this. I just read it somewhere. But
okay.
Was this the first compact car? Did you read that? Or was it the first car considered to be compact?
Yeah.
That fell into that category, right?
Yeah. We've got a pretty cool article on our website that talks a little bit about this. And the smaller companion car had been thought of before by Chevrolet. They contemplated something called the Cadet, if you recall. That was a prototype, four-door sedan, right after World War II.
But see, the difference is this one went into production, right?
Exactly.
All right, and it's a very unusual production car. And, you know, can I take one quick sidebar here before we get into just some of the immediate details about the initial Corvair?
Let's consider this a sidebar-heavy podcast. I think we're going to have some fun with this one.
I think I read somewhere that George Romney, former governor of Michigan,
I believe he
coined the term compact car.
Really?
I just picked that up somewhere. I don't remember where I got it, but that's Mitt Romney's father, you know, former presidential candidate, Mitt Romney. It was his father, who was also the governor of Michigan, coined the term compact car. Before that, it had just never, it was never even a category.
That's fascinating.
And it kind of makes sense that, you know, up until 1960, I mean, this was considered, if you look at a Corvair, it's still kind of a bigger car. Our compact cars now are much smaller.
Yep.
But this one had some unusual features to it. It was a rear engine. We mentioned that it was an air-cooled, it was an air-cooled flat six.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a pretty complex engine, too.
Yeah, it really was. And it very, compact, you know, very small. It fit underneath the floor, floorboards in, well, you know what? I'm getting ahead. In another vehicle.
Yes.
In the Corvair, you opened up the, what would be the trunk, and that was the engine compartment, of course.
Right.
It was a rear-wheel drive vehicle. Had about three engines. I think there was even a turbo thrown in there somewhere, but there was a 2.3, a 2.4, and a 2.7 liter by the end. Had a three or a four speed manual transmission, and you could get a, or you could get a two speed power glide automatic, which is kind of unusual.
Yeah. Yeah.
Two speed automatic.
And let's go ahead and point out that these were heavy engines because, despite having a lightweight block, an aluminum block, they were weighing in at 366 pounds, which is above the target weight.
That's pretty heavy, really, considering it's still a compact engine. It's just probably a lot of iron in there. Now, I want to point this out, though.
Yes.
A lot of this, it was an extremely popular car when it was released, and I get to that in just one moment.
Right.
But it was very, very popular. The 1960 reception of this vehicle was very, very favorable. And I want to point out that there were a lot of other cars that were designed or, you know, but they were built in other countries that were designed almost nearly identical to this one in weight distribution and suspension design. And later that becomes extremely important. But if you want to look at cars like, well, especially in Europe, there was the VW Beetle, you know, the Type 1 Beetle, the very first one.
Right.
The Porsche 911, the Fiat 500, the original Fiat 500. There was also a car called the Skoda, which had, it was a Czechoslovakian car, so it had a similar engine layout design, you know, rear-wheel drive, same weight distribution, everything. There's a real trick to driving a rear-engine car that I'm sure a lot of Porsche drivers can attest to, that corners are handled completely different than they are in a front-engine rear-wheel drive car, front-engine front-wheel drive. You know, they all have their own characteristics. A rear-engine rear-wheel drive car that has this type of suspension that was a is what GM called a quadriflex independent suspension, which, you know, again, was similar to the Porsche, VW, even Mercedes of the day. This independent suspension seemed to cause a lot of trouble with American drivers that just didn't simply know the handling characteristics of it.
Right.
And if you weren't, you know, up to speed on, you know, the way, I don't know if that's a good way to say it, if you weren't monitoring your air pressure, your tire pressure all the time. That became critical as well. There's so much to this story. I keep jumping ahead, but
you think let's be honest, you think the Corvair got a bad rap?
I do, because in 1960, when it was first released, I mean, I said it was extremely popular, right?
Yeah, it was lauded. I want to go back to the tire pressure here, because one of the big factors in the vehicle's performance would be observing the recommended tire pressure. That's 15 in the front, 26 in the rear, pounds per square inch. And of course.
Wait, 15 in the front?
I've got 15 in the front.
Okay.
And 26 in the rear. Now, when this happens, you know, a lot of drivers, let's be honest, folks, are not doing the manufacturer recommended safety check that you are supposed to do every time you enter your vehicle.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, right. That's up with our driving laws no one follows.
Yeah,
show.
I know.
But point being, this rear axle, as you say, Scott, does drive completely differently to a front axle. However, when this vehicle came out, people liked it.
Yeah, they loved it. In 1960, just to give you an idea, I mean, I can kind of, we'll go to the mid 60s. How about that?
Okay.
In 1960, there were amazing sales numbers. I mean, we're talking like in the first 2 days that it was available to the public, 26,000 units sold. In 2 days, Ben, they sold 26,000 Corvairs. That represents a full 35% of Chevy's total sales for those 2 days. Now that means that, now that also is to me is incredible. That means that that day, you know, that those 2 days, Chevrolet sold 75,000 cars. Corvairs accounted for 26,000 of those 75,000 cars in just 2 days.
Which is fascinating because for the total 1960 Corvair production in the U.S., now this is production, not cars sold.
Okay.
It was only 250,000.
Well, that's quite a bit still. That's a high production number.
Yeah,
but,
for a first year or two.
But, I mean, for geez, what is that? How was that, 1% of the sales to sell it in 2 days? That's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
But anyways, it also got an extremely favorable review by Time Magazine in 1959. So this is prior to the release, you know,
right,
just prior to 1960. They called it a, what did they say? It was the new age of innovation in Detroit. Mm-hmm. And it was based on, or they called it a forerunner of new innovation in Detroit. They said it was, you know, a car based on fresh engineering is what they said.
Yeah.
So they were all for this car, right? And that's critical, or not critical, but important later when you hear what happens.
It was something different. And to quote Arby's, something different is good. Did I do that right?
I think that's good.
I think I'm just hungry.
Arby's, okay. So also in 1960,
it
was named Motor Trend's Car of the Year. Mm-hmm. So that's a huge award to win right there.
Big accolade.
Let's see. I guess that's about it. I mean, but, you know, by the time in the mid-60s, you know, we get into the second generation and, you know, like even people like David E. Davis, who is Car and Driver's editor, he said something like, you know, the Corvair is one of the most important new car models of this entire crop of 1965 models. It's one of the most beautiful cars to appear in the country World War II. So they get very excited about the Corvair, and I don't want to gloss over too much here because in, you know, 1960, or from that point forward, I guess, they really came out with there was a lot of variety in the Corvair line.
Right, and when we're saying variety, we mean not just models, but also body styles, right?
Exactly, yeah, and there's more to this than you really think, because, I mean, when I was looking at used cars, and, you know, these were popping up all over the place, you know, now they're in, like, classic car magazines and stuff, but
yeah.
They offered, and these are two-door and four-door versions, okay? They had a convertible, they had a coupe, they had a sedan, they even had a station wagon for a while. Which gave rise to something called the Chevrolet Greenbrier, which is a van and, like, those are both the van and station wagon, I should say. Those are both based on the Corvair. They had an 8-door van. They had a 6-door model as well. This is cool. Well, okay, they had a hardtop. And then, Ben, this is maybe the coolest one.
What's that?
I like the pickup truck. They had a 2-door pickup truck that was based on the Corvair, and it was called one of two things. It was either called the Loadside or the Ramp Side. And the ramp side, this is so neat. It has a really short wheelbase, pickup truck bed. It has kind of like a van front end, so it's real tall and squat in the front. Now, the engine remains in the back in all of these models. Now,
right.
This is what's unusual. So you got a van that has a rear engine. You got a
station wagon.
You got a pickup truck that has a rear engine. Now, the way they did it was they raised the floor in the back a little bit at the very back end of the tailgate, but that's not really the tailgate. Mm-hmm. This is the cool thing. The passenger side had a almost like a door. It looked like a gate, like you would find on the back of a pickup truck now, but it was longer. You know, it was the half of the body work, you know, going up. And you would lower this down, and you could, you know, wheel in a wheelbarrow, or you could load in a lawnmower or something like that. A very short bed pickup truck, but it had this really unusual feature, and it was that ramp side, on just one side, on the passenger side. It's a neat-looking car, and I think it you know, it makes its way into, you know, shows here and there. You'll find lots of photos online if you search for Rampside Corvair. And anyways, I think that's really cool. So this Greenbrier line of vehicles, you know, you could get panel vans, you could get window vans, you could get all kinds of options in these station wagons, aside from the sedans and coupes and convertibles and all those that they sold.
So our point being here that the Corvair dynasty was proliferating. It was doing fairly well. I was fighting with myself over whether or not to include this, but I think we should go ahead and also include just a mention of the Corvair Monza. The Monza made a lot of people aware that there was a market for sporty cars. So it showed that there was yet another side of this Corvair dynasty.
Yeah. Now picture the cars that were being made in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
They were pretty big. They were you know, long, wide, low cars, and extremely heavy. You know, they had giant engines in them, great big V8s. So here's this, you know, this air-cooled V6 that's, you know, got a totally different layout, very, very small compared to what's out there, you know, at the time. A lot of people were I don't know. It was popular, but still, a lot of people were probably looking at it, thinking like, "What's Chevrolet doing here? What are they doing? Actually, what is Ed Cole doing? Because Ed Cole was the
the creative mind behind it.
Exactly, and he was like I mentioned, the general manager of Chevrolet within General Motors. And he was actually, just to give you a little bit of background on him, not much, but he was called the father of Chevrolet's small block V8, which is a hugely popular engine that, stayed around for a long, long time. I don't have the 350 numbers, but the small block V8 was big. But he was what they call the champion of the Corvair in 1959. He was the one who said, this is my group. This is what, I'm going to go out there and really, really sell this to the public. We're going to make this really popular. And he did just that. He completely directed the development of the Corvair. So he was, he was completely on board with this thing. Mm-hmm. The problem was, that later, as he began, he was promoted out of the division. Mm-hmm. He eventually became head of GM and, car and truck group in 1961. So that's not much later.
Yeah.
He became the executive vice president of all of General Motors in 1965. And by 1967, he was the president of General Motors. So, he was on his way up. One name that creeps into this whole thing, and I just need to mention it now because later, we'll get into other stuff later, but eventually the person who became, the Chevy division general manager was John DeLorean.
Ah, and anybody who thinks that they might recognize that last name, you are correct, ladies and gentlemen. That is the same father of the DeLorean car.
Yeah, I mean, he was like, you remember who DeLorean was. Now, this is like late in the 60s, so, I only want to mention this now because I know we won't get to it later. Because we've got this whole bit about the controversy coming
up. Right, while we're here.
But anyways, DeLorean in 1969, that's when he became the Chevy division general manager. Mm-hmm. And DeLorean, he was like a celebrity at the time, right? And he was making appearances with movie stars and starlets, and he was traveling all over the place, and he was really making the rounds, right? I mean, like heads of the movie industry and music stars and everything. He was just a big shot at the time, right? And mm-hmm. he went from Chrysler to Packard to GM, and eventually onto his own DeLorean Motor Car Company, right?
And we have a show all about that. So in case you guys are worried that we're going to skim over it, we are in this episode. But check out our iTunes and our RSS because we have an episode on the DeLorean.
Exactly, and he was also a big deal at the time.
Yep.
Because he had just moved from the Pontiac division. He was in GM for quite a while, and he moved around, mm-hmm. within the ranks there. He was with the Pontiac division for a while, and one of his greatest accomplishments, if you remember, was the Pontiac GTO. So, he's kind of on board with these, that's the first muscle car, really, in a lot of people's eyes.
Yes.
And so he was on board with something that's, sleek and powerful and, exciting. And I'll be honest, I don't think he really put a whole lot of faith in the Corvair brand or the Corvair name for the Chevrolet brand at the end of the 60s when it needed it most, Ben.
Yeah, and let's also, now that we're starting to talk about the faith in the name, let's also point out that internally, the Corvair was not necessarily as popular with his executives as you might imagine. There was internal division amongst both the sales teams and the engineering teams.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it didn't probably get the type of promotion that a lot of other makes would have gotten or marks would have gotten.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's accurate to say that the Corvair did not necessarily get a fair shot in comparison to other vehicles.
Now, also complicating this whole matter, we've got something within General Motors that was, far more popular at the time, the Corvette.
Yes.
Right? Now, that's that's one that was just getting all of the Chevrolet attention at the time. That was like the rock star of the group, right?
Right.
Now, but in addition to that, there was competition, right?
Mm-hmm.
The competition came from Ford and from, again, from Chevrolet in the later part of the 1960s.
Right.
Now, Ford came out with a pivotal model that that's still popular today, right?
The Mustang.
Yeah, the Mustang. Now, it's competing with the first-generation Mustang. I don't know how you would even stay afloat if you're competing against that.
Yeah, and what's interesting, and this is why we bring up the Monza earlier, what's interesting is that some people will say that the Corvair Monza proved that there was a market for these sporty cars in the United States, and that perhaps that proof of concept led to, you know, to reverse the old cliche, became the antidote that created the poison. Because after that, of course, people at Ford are seeing this, and then boom, what comes out? The Mustang. Somebody should high five Lee Iacocca.
Yeah,
he's a clever guy.
You know, the whole thing with like the pony car competition in the 1960s,
right,
that became so big that something like the Corvair just slowly started to drop off of people's radar. And by the mid 60s, you know, it was probably, I don't know, still sort of popular at the time. I mean, the sales numbers were still decent. They weren't anything fantastic like they were in the initial year or two.
Yeah.
By the mid-60s, I would say that, you know, numbers were starting to trail off. And when I say mid-60s, I mean 64, 65, that era.
Okay. That's accurate.
By 1966, though, however, should we just do it? This is probably it.
Yeah. Quick preface just for the background. What we have mentioned is that the public was unaccustomed to a rear axle vehicle, right? Largely unaccustomed in the United States. And then some other negative factors sort of converged, right,
yeah,
Scott?
Yeah, here's the part that people are probably anxious to get to, because this is what I had always heard now. There's a guy named Ralph Nader.
Whom some of you may be familiar with.
Yeah. He's still around. Ralph
also, like Mitt Romney, former presidential candidate.
Am I mistaken? He's still around, isn't he? He's still,
I believe so, yes.
Alive and kicking, right?
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, at the time he was a young attorney. He was a consumer advocate. And, he grabbed onto one little fact here about the Corvair that we mentioned earlier. Remember, we said that it had this, what do we call it, a quadriflex independent suspension. Now, that means it's four-wheel independent suspension.
Yeah.
With the characteristics of, you know, the rear-wheel drive, rear-engine layout, that made this car a little different handling, right? You know, the Europeans had already kind of taken care of. They've already mastered this, really, with a lot of other vehicles. They're quick to point out that, you know, Porsche 911 drivers didn't have any of the same issues, but
right,
there were some handling problems with the Corvair, and it was based on, you know, that they just didn't, the American consumer just didn't have any idea really how to handle that type of layout and how to drive that type of layout successfully. There were a lot of problems. In fact, there were like 100 lawsuits that GM was facing at the time.
Yes, and let's also point out, in defense of the American driver here, that because the engine was heavier than they expected, almost 80 pounds over its target weight, there were some negative consequences for handling. It would oversteer. That is true. But did this problem get exaggerated? I think it is fair to say yes.
Well, you know, okay, there's a couple things that Nader jumps on here.
Right.
And the thing is that probably that gained his attention was that there are a lot of consumers that are suing General Motors over accidents that have happened in the Corvair. You know, like, I don't know what the accidents were, if they were rollover, if they involved.
They were, a lot of them were being called tuck under. So a swing axle suspension, right, has the possibility for the axle to tuck under because there's a lack of a front stabilizer bar. And again, we've mentioned the kind of unusual tire pressure.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, anybody familiar with tire pressure knows that 15 front, 26 rear, that's cold, is an odd pressure.
That's an awful unusual thing to do.
It's a weird ratio too.
A lot of people weren't keeping up with that, I'm sure. Now the thing is that, you know, he found out that, you know, there's all these he's a consumer advocate, I mentioned.
Yes.
An attorney. So he's right away jumping on General Motors saying, you know, there's something not right here. What are we going to do? Found out that, you know, the GM, engineers had made the decision to remove, the front anti-sway bars for cost savings measure. Now, they saved about $4 per car, according to some estimates.
Yeah.
By removing that front anti-sway bar, which would have stabilized the whole thing and minimized, not prevented all of these accidents, right?
Right. Minimized is good.
Minimized is probably the best way, because, you know, who knows the situation in every, well, who knows every situation.
Yeah, we're
right?
Not like hypothesis wizards,
no, exactly,
or whatever.
Exactly. So he goes to the point where he's actually testifying against General Motors in a congressional hearing. Now, GM did make the change later on. They updated the suspension and they added the sway bar.
Yeah, in 65?
Yeah, in 60, five or six. I can't remember which. But the problem is this book that Ralph had written.
Ah, yes.
Published in 1965, and it was a book called Unsafe at Any Speed.
The Designed In Dangers of the American Automobile.
Ah, okay. So now, you mentioned something that I had not heard, though, that really the Corvair only warrants one chapter in this book.
Yeah, that's
right?
That's weird. It's kind of like, it reminded me of, you know how everybody talks about the invisible hand mentioned in some of the basic text on economics.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the invisible hand, the actual reasoning of that phrase only appears a couple of times in that book. And the Corvair, the book Unsafe at Any Speed, has the following premise. It says that there is a systemic resistance by car makers to introduce stuff like seatbelts or other safety features, and that this is a choice to save money rather than improve safety.
I see. Now, okay.
So there's definitely an agenda here. There's an argument.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Now, the $4 per car, whenever, you know, somebody would probably say, like, well, why wouldn't you put that in for $4 if it's going to save someone's life? They don't see it that way. They see it as, like, well, here's a car that we've tested to be safe. We know that it handles exactly like cars of its class.
Right.
The cars of, like, the 911, the Beetle that we mentioned, you know, all the Skoda, all those that we mentioned. It handles in exactly the same way, the same manner. Why would we put an additional $4 option on there that we're going to end up having to charge our consumers an extra $10 for? Now, considering
to deliver.
Considering that this is a, yeah, to deliver, you know, by, you know, as far as they their cost is $4. By the time it gets to the dealer lot and to the individual purchase of the car, the consumer, that ends up being a $25 piece or whatever it is, right?
Right.
Now you laugh, I know, but $25 doesn't sound like much, but consider the cars were right around the, you know, $2,000 range brand new. Mm-hmm. That's a significant increase in price.
Yeah.
And of course they're doing everything they can to shave, you know, costs. They want to keep their consumers safe. They don't want to kill their consumers. They don't want them to be injured in any way either.
Right.
You
and
lose
they're
a
legal.
Customer.
Yeah, they're legally not allowed to sell vehicles that don't meet safety standards in the United States. One thing that might be interesting for a lot of our listeners is that every vehicle, even vehicles that seem to have been made the same way from year to model year, are always being updated, if only in terms of matching safety standards. Because safety standards evolve over time.
And safety standards, like you mentioned, like the seatbelts and all that, that all cost manufacturers. And they decide, well, you know, early on they can probably decide that that's an option we want to include. Like you'll find a lot of the high-end vehicles include a lot of these options way before anybody else.
Yeah.
You know, so that they can say, like, we've got this, the competitors don't. However, when it becomes a mandated safety feature, like, you know, front lap belts were in cars in the mid-60s or whenever, then you couldn't really advertise, like, we've got front lap belts because your competitors got it. Everybody's got it. Every car manufactured has to have that. So it doesn't become a selling point at that. So I'm just trying to say that, you know, GM at the time, they weren't doing anything illegal by not including the anti-sway bar.
Mm-hmm.
They did update it when they realized, like, there's a call for this that, you know, maybe that would help in, you know, the handling characteristics, et cetera.
Yeah.
But they weren't doing anything wrong by not including that other than saving $4 per car. And just to give you an idea of how many cars they were making.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, I said that the book published in 1965 and, you know, Nader's claims, that, you know, were very, very damaging to General Motors.
Right. And they center on the models of 60 to 63.
Okay. 60 to 63. So the initial 3 years of production. Now the model sales went, and I told you about, you know, the first day sale, 2 day sales rather.
Yeah.
In 1965, they were still selling, this is per year, 220,000 Corvairs a year, which is an awful lot of Corvairs
out
there.
Nothing to sneeze at.
220,000 were sold in 1965. By 1966, after the book had been released, that number was cut in less than half. They're cut in more than half,
mm-hmm.
rather. They were down to less than 120,000 in 1966. And then by 1968, that number is all the way down to less than 15,000 cars.
So
a dramatic drop-off.
So now the here's the thing that we mentioned earlier. The book, Unsafe at Any Speed, while it definitely does have an opinion, he also does do his research and he talks with people who are in the industry. Now, what some people may not know about this book is that it's not all about the Corvair. it's become widely associated with the Corvair, but it's like that Mark Twain definition of a classic. Everybody loves it, nobody reads it. Mm-hmm. The primary focus of the Corvair is in Chapter 1, which, check out this title, Scott, for Chapter 1.
What's that?
The Sporty Corvair, The One Car Accident. And, in this, based largely on some conversations with a guy named George Caramagna, Chevrolet suspension mechanic, they say that the missing bar, that sway bar we're talking about, had caused crashes. Caramagna was against the whole thing, against the removal of it. But I think we would be remiss if we didn't point out that when Joel sent us this on Twitter, one of the things that he said about this was that the Corvair was not killed by Ralph Nader.
Hmm.
He said, That's the hint. It wasn't killed by Ralph Nader. And I want to go ahead and check out just a couple of statements that other people had made about the Corvair because,
Everybody jumped on the bandwagon at this point, right?
Uh-huh.
That's probably kind of what's going on, right? It wasn't just him, but he started the ball rolling, I think, right?
Right. I think he's more of a – he's less of a single cause and maybe more of a feather on a camel's back because here's where we should mention something straight from the article that Joel sent us. Contrary to myth, the Corvair was not scrubbed because of Ralph Nader's attacks. Chevrolet documents examined by several writers prove that the word had been passed to start development of a conventional front-engine, rear-drive car in 1964, before the new Corvairs hit the street. This was likely prompted by the success of the Mustang, introduced in the spring of that year, and it was decided well before Nader's book published. Can you guess what that car was, Scott?
Let me guess the Monza.
I'm
sorry. I said Monza. Monza's the Corvair. I want to say, no, I don't know.
The Camaro.
Camaro. Okay. All right. Well, I'll think of the car that I was thinking of at this point here. Not that the Monza is a Corvair. Okay.
Yes.
So I do want to also point this out. From 1962 to 1964, there were changes that were made by Chevrolet to the Corvair as far as handling characteristics. Now, they were reacting to the lawsuits that were happening.
Right.
Before the book came out, before the congressional hearings, before all this is going on.
And those congressional hearings weren't until 1972.
Yeah, they happened much, much later. Now, that's actually the proof of what's all going on here, and we'll get to that because the findings are very interesting.
Yes, they are.
But for 1962, so we're talking 2 years after the launch of this thing,
mm-hmm.
3 years prior to the book, Chevrolet did offer the front anti-roll bar as an option. And for 1964 model year, the 64 model year and on, now remember Nader, his focus was on 1960 to 63, I think.
Right.
For the 1964 model and forward, the anti-sway bar, the anti-roll bar, became standard equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And they even modified the rear suspension a bit, you know, adding different components to make that even sturdier. So they did react quickly.
Right.
They reacted appropriately.
And responsibly.
And responsibly, yes. And somehow still in 1965, this book comes out, you know, slaying them for the models from 1960 to 1963. Seems like that could be just an update. Like, okay, well, we've changed it for the 64. Bring it back into the dealership, you know, spend $20 and we'll update it and make it safer for you. Or, you know, maybe we will institute a recall or something
right,
like that.
Yeah.
I just don't know how it was all working at the time. I'm not sure if they even did that back then.
Well, let's talk about that congressional inquiry.
Okay.
So that's 1972, huh?
Yeah, 1972.
Years after the fact.
1972, so they get some people to investigate what really happened, right? And one that you'll find most often mentioned here is the Texas A&M University study. And they conducted a series of tests, and they had a press release that actually came out in 1972 that describes what they handed it off to the NHTSA, which is, you know, the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration.
Mm-hmm.
They handed it off to them to do comparative tests or to evaluate this, right? And they said that the handling, the study, which actually was released in 71, says that the 63 Corvair and four contemporary cars, the Ford Falcon, the Plymouth Valiant, Volkswagen Beetle, and Renault Dauphine, along with the second generation Corvair, which was completely redesigned, you know, with all the new suspension
right.
bits and everything, that it handled exactly the same way. It handled exactly the way it should and exactly the way that, you know, the other cars of its class handled mm-hmm. in that day.
And so this means that based on this study and other evidence, funny story, the 72 congressional investigation cleared the 60 to 63 models.
Yeah, it's incredible. It says the handling, I'll quote it, the handling and stability performance of the 1960 to 1963 Corvair does not result in an abnormal potential for loss of control or rollover and is at least as good as the performance of some of the contemporary vehicles, both foreign and domestic. So, again, cleared them completely.
But too late.
Yeah.
$4 per car too little and $4 per car too late.
All right. However, I've got a note here somewhere. I'll never find it in the mess that I've created over here with this nest of notes that I've made.
Sure.
But I also heard that, you know, when you mentioned that they were going to advance this other vehicle, which was what?
The Camaro?
I forget it already. Okay, the Camaro, which was in direct competition with Corvair and, you know, meant to compete with the Mustang.
Mm-hmm.
The point about this was that in 1967, I believe, they ceased all advertising of the Corvair. And even if you went into a dealership, you had to ask specifically for a Corvair brochure to be handed to you. Mm-hmm. They didn't just have it out on the rack available. You know, I don't even know if you had to order one or what, but it was that kind of, well, we still offer that model, but we're not going to have it on our showroom floor. We're not even going to give you information about it.
You can order it, but it's not on the menu anymore.
No, and prior to that, you know, there were all these models and different mm-hmm. types, and people were excited about the Corvair, and now, you know, it's become kind of this backroom deal, which is a little weird, isn't it?
Yeah, it is weird, and I want to also point out, because I don't want to beat the guy up too much, Ralph Nader, when he's writing this book, let's keep in mind that he's doing it as a consumer advocate. His heart's in the right place.
True.
He's not out to do some, you know, shadowy yellow journalism hatchet job. He does have the right intentions in mind. Does the problem get fixed? Yes. Does Chevy get cleared? Yes. But unfortunately, we will probably never see as many Corvairs as we could have, or know how the rest of the story plays out. Scott.
Well, okay. I've got a little different take on this.
Take it.
Because you remember I said about the advertising dropping off and the new vehicle and all that? It probably was scheduled to fade away anyways. I think that maybe even prior to this, maybe in the mid-60s, maybe it was going to go away. Maybe they didn't intend to have it until 1969 like they did. But remember I mentioned DeLorean earlier. This is where he comes back in. Now, 1969, DeLorean is back. He's now in charge of the Chevrolet division as general manager.
Yes.
I don't think he really gave too much care of – he didn't care too much about the Corvair and what really happened to the Corvair. It just kind of died off.
You know who did, though?
Who did?
Bill Mitchell.
Really?
Yeah, Bill Mitchell, one of the – we've – this guy.
That's interesting.
We like him so much that we have a podcast on him, too.
Yeah.
Bill Mitchell was trying to push for continuing development of this. He was a guy who was apparently hard to say no to.
Well, he was the styling guy, right? Who
was
in charge of the Corvette, the Mako Shark and all that. He was a really interesting guy that I really like the Bill Mitchell story.
And Bill's whole idea was that he would hate for somebody else to come to him and say, as he was, as you said, VP of styling, he would hate for somebody else from the executive board to come to him and say, what's next? And for him to say, oh, I don't know. Yeah. He always needed to have something. So he wanted to continue pushing for the style. But to your point, I don't know if it's too much of a different take there, because I agree, it seems like from the research that we've done that maybe the Corvair had more enemies inside GM than it did outside.
Oh, possibly. That's a very real possibility, and I guess unless you were a fly on the wall in those days, you probably wouldn't know. Now, I had an uncle that worked there during these days. I think I remember telling you this during the Bill Mitchell days.
Yeah, yeah.
He was a designer at Chevrolet. And in the Corvette area, you know, that region of the style and design, he was an engineer. And I wish he's no longer with us. I wish so badly, Ben, that I could go and talk to him now and ask him about what was going on. Because now I'm really into this. I'm really deep into what was going on. I know all the names. I know all the players that were there right when he was there, right in the heart of the beast, right in the belly of the beast, Ben. He was right there. He could have told me all of the dirt on Bill Mitchell and DeLorean and all those guys, but you know, when I knew him or when I was around this uncle, I was too young. I was still interested in cars.
Yeah.
But I didn't have, I had no idea that, you know, I would ever need to know this type of thing or be interested in this, you know, right. this much detail. So, I just wish he was still around. I could still talk to him about it. Cause that's, you know, just, if you got somebody like that around, just talk to him now and get all the stories you can out of him because it's so valuable.
It's true. So,
but, God, I'm getting choked up.
One last thing though.
Yeah, yeah. I've got, okay.
I've got one last
sure.
thing. My last thing is that remember how we said that Time magazine lauded the Corvair?
Yes.
And now, surprise, surprise, it's a bit of a tut-tut kind of surprise. The 1961 Corvair is on the 50 worst cars list.
Yes.
Let me just read a brief description here. Chevrolet execs knew the Corvair was a handful. They declined to spend the few dollars per car to make the swing axle rear suspension more manageable. Oh, they came to regret that. And then it goes on. It says, the Corvair had other problems. It leaked oil like a derelict tanker. Its heating system pumped noxious fumes in the cabin. Even so, says the Time writer, my family had a Corvair, white with red interior, and we loved it.
Okay, so here's the deal. 1959, they love the car. I think it's great. You know, they review it. It's perfect. By what year is this list? 2007, I think?
Yes.
It makes this Time magazine 50 worst cars of all time. And I don't know how many times, Ben, our listeners have sent us, you know, something from this list, or we've, you know, sent something out from this list.
Yeah.
Because for Time magazine to call it one of the 50 worst of all time, that's a pretty bold statement, right? Now, I want to quickly go through this, because I've got a couple things here still.
Okay.
I've got one surprise coming for you in just a moment, so hang on for that.
I'm waiting.
I will give you that before the end of the podcast, I promise, okay?
All right.
Something that surprised you and hopefully the listeners too. Corvair related.
Okay.
Okay. Promise I'll get to it. So now the way I see this is the Time magazine thing. Now the problems, of course, that are mentioned here, you know, one thing that they mention is, the handling.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, of course, it's a rear end. We've mentioned all this already. It's a rear engine car with a tendency to spin out because of the way people drive it. You know, the weight in the back, it's going to have a loose back end. That's just the way it's going to be. The swing axle rear suspension design, that's something that you just need to learn how to drive and Porsche drivers seem to have not had a problem with this. I mean, some have, but, you know, they figure it out eventually. Also, there's this issue about a single-piece steering column. It was not a telescoping design. However, if you think back, now this is the 1961 Corvair that they're talking about here.
Right. And that that column specifically is referenced in Unsafe at Any Speed.
Okay. So the single-piece steering column. I want you to remember, though, like how new that design is because – in 1955, the Ford Thunderbird had a telescoping steering column, which is designed so that when you get in a front-end accident, the steering column doesn't go right through your chest.
Right, that the steering column can retract within itself.
Yeah, like an antenna, like, you know, the old antennas that would
like
push down.
Yeah, like a car antenna.
Yeah, like a car antenna, like an old antenna. But in 1955, the Ford Thunderbird had a telescoping design. Now, you may think, like, okay, it's been around, you know, for 8 years prior to that or whatever, 6 years prior. Not the case, because it was only an option in the Cadillac in 1965 as a telescoping design.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm telling you, like, there's this time in between 1955 and 1965 when it wasn't standard equipment on every car.
Yeah.
It was just simply another design feature that this one just didn't have. Now the safety mandates and everything, they made them have them later, as we talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But I just want to give you an idea that, you know, it wasn't even an option on the Cadillac until 1965. So why would it be on this Chevy Monza, this compact car, in 1961 or 1960 or whenever it was? I think that's an important point to mark there. Also, leaked oil. So what? I've got a car from 2005 right now that leaks oil. I've got, you know, every car I've ever owned has leaked oil, especially, you know, the British cars that I've owned. They're terribly.
Ooh, we're going to get some letters.
Oil leakers. No, they're known oil leakers, so that's not a big deal. But, I mean, even the project car that I have, everything I do to seal that thing up, it leaks oil.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a huge deal.
Now I'm going to get you some oil case for your birthday, by the way.
I probably need it. And the last thing, the heating system. They had this gas heater in the front of the car, which sounds crazy.
Yeah.
But that was kind of a popular option at the time. A lot of companies were doing that type of thing. And it was an option that you opted to buy.
Right.
And it was a gasoline-powered heater that heated the compartment of the car. I know it sounds terrible to do now, but that's what they did, and it wasn't all that uncommon. Now, let's get back into the Corvair here.
Yeah, you've got a surprise.
I have a surprise. Now, I'm going to have to pass you a piece of paper here, so bear with me, listeners, here as I do this. But take a look at the bottom of that page, Ben.
What is this?
That is from 1966.
Holy smoke.
And see, I knew I was going to surprise you with this.
I am surprised.
This is a 1966 Electrovare 2. Now, you might imagine I said 2, Ben.
Yeah, I noticed you said 2.
So, it's a battery electric car. Now, I said 2 because the first Electrovare was built on a 1964 Corvair. Which was converted to electric drive, but they had a few problems with it. They sorted it out. Mm-hmm. This version here, I found it in a book that we have on our shelves here at How Stuff Works. It's a really cool model. Now, I mean, you look under the hood, in the trunk, and in the engine compartment, and it's dramatically different from the Corvair from 1966. It's built on a Monza model.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a 115 horsepower electric motor. These are silver zinc batteries. They completely fill the front trunk and the rear engine compartment, other than where you see the motor in there.
Yeah.
Not the engine compartment. It used to be the motor compartment at this point.
Right.
And this car had a top speed of 80 miles per hour.
Wow.
It had a range of 40 to 80 miles.
1966.
It had a range of 40 to 80 miles on all electric power. Now, consider some of the cars today where, you know, the range is around 40 miles.
Yeah.
That's pretty remarkable. So 0 to 60, not very remarkable. That was about 16 seconds, because you can imagine these batteries were extremely heavy. They were
silver zinc
batteries. Yeah. The car weighs 3,400 pounds. That's about 1,000 pounds heavier than the Monza in its traditional form. Mm-hmm. with the engine that we had mentioned before.
Like the comparable gas-powered
one. The flat six, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so I thought you would be impressed by seeing this, and if you're near a computer, somebody please Google this car. It's pretty amazing to look at. A 1966 Electrovare 2, and just for the battery packs alone, that's a cool shot.
Yeah, that's really cool. I am surprised. Thank you for sending that to us, the Electrovare 2. And I guess this is our way to wrap up the rise and fall of the Chevy Corvair. Hats off once again. As we know, cars can be a murderous cutthroat business.
I want to say one more thing.
If
I had known then what I know now about the Corvair, now how many times people say that, but if I had known then what I know now about the Corvair, I would have definitely have considered it as a possibility for one of my first cars, if not, you know, first, second, third, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
But, and who knows, maybe, I mean, they're a little bit more scarce now,
mm-hmm.
but if I see one come up for sale, I won't look the other way now. Because I really, until we started digging into this, I just had such a bad connotation with the Corvair, and it was unnecessary.
So we hope that we've given you some food for thought, especially regarding the Corvair, listeners. Don't let its bad press totally turn you off. But please do tell us what you'd like to hear more about. Feel free to send us, you know, limericks, funny anecdotes, pictures of your cars. Scott's shaking his head. No,
don't send us limericks.
No limericks, huh? I'm going to send us limericks. You can check in with us on Facebook. You can give us a holler on Twitter. And if you would like to write to us, as did Sir Fast Sandy.
Yeah, Sir Mr.
Mr. Fast Sandy.
Mr. Fast Sandy.
Again, our email address is
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.